Hello again, this is Josh Carr at The Real Angle, and today I'm speaking with John Allen, founder and president of Streamline Development Group. John, how are you doing today?
Hey, Josh, doing well. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you for joining. And the first thing I always like to notice when I call someone in a market like San Diego and I'm calling from New Jersey is I'm wearing a sweater and you are not. So congratulations on your choice of location. And so those of us
all day today, short sleeves all day.
I know it is. It is a Southern California. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. Oh, yeah. Anyway. And by the way, I'll just say that for you, if it blurs a little bit, don't worry about it. Like by the time the recording's done, it'll all clear up. I just thought I'd say that. And that's sorry for everyone listening. That's a little inside baseball on our side. And one other thing I always like to get out of the way before we get started, because if I don't, someone invariably asks. The web address for his company is streamlinedevelopmentgroup.com, common spelling, so I'm sure you'll be able to find that. So let's talk a little bit. What do you do at Streamline? When did you start it? Give me a little bit of a background, if you will.
Sure. Yeah, I'll give you a little elevator pitch. We are a San Diego-based urban infill development company. We focus primarily on ground-up development projects in core San Diego markets.
Cool.
Like you said, I'm the president and founder of the company in 2016. I actually took a very unconventional route in the development world. I didn't work up the corporate ladder at a large development company and eventually branch off, anything like that. My career arc is a little bit more scrappy, boots to the ground. You know, I actually was grinding as a bartender at nights and on weekends during college and after college, and set up a development company during the week and during normal business hours. So
fantastic.
So it definitely unconventional, worked my way into, obtaining properties eventually. My start in real estate was actually really early. My dad is a contractor, so I spent a decent amount of time on construction sites, which really piqued my interest in building. In 2008, while doing my undergrad at San Diego State University, I actually started a nonprofit development company that focused on tax credit projects. And that's really where I cut my teeth conducting underwriting, processing entitlements and permits, and then transitioned into the market rate side where I founded
Streamline. So I have a couple questions just to throw it out there. So first off, I mean, your comment about coming to it through a non-traditional route, you know, I've always kidded around that, like, very few children say, "Dad, when I grow up, I want to be a real estate developer," right? I mean, you know, a doctor, fireman, fine, but most people don't say real estate. So in all fairness, I think a lot of us come to it from odd backgrounds. But yeah, I mean, the fact that you came up through the contracting side, or at least viewing it the contracting side, that makes a lot of sense. The not-for-profit angle is interesting. So you started a not-for-profit development company. What was the impetus behind that?
Well, my family comes from difficult backgrounds. My dad was a former foster care kid. And so okay. I know the difficulty in which he grew up, and a lot of it due to not having home foster care kids, or, you know, they have trouble finding work, trouble finding their footing in society. He was fortunately able to,
sure.
But the vast majority are not. And so
it's a hard start.
Starting the 501c, the nonprofit, was to provide entrepreneurial opportunities for disadvantaged and at-risk youth. Basically, long story short, is trying to set up construction projects, building projects, and provide pre-apprenticeship programs and opportunities to get into the building trade through our developments. And so the way that we did that was to go under construction. We set up a program upon which we brought in, homeless youth or disadvantaged youth, and provided them with essentially a paid internship, paid working opportunities, job site equipment, and access into local apprenticeship programs for which they could choose their trade, whether it's a plumber, an electrician, or a carpenter. They would be able to get in, skip the line, and get credit towards that program by working on our job site. So that was the main impetus for starting the nonprofit. alongside, you know, my sure. passion for development was also trying to be good by doing good.
No, that's great. I mean, look, a lot of people, I mean, it's an industry-wide problem. We don't have enough people in the trades. So anything we can do to get more people into the trades is a win. I mean, I laugh about, you know, there's a lot of discussion about, say, the growth of electric cars and electric car chargers. But I read a piece recently just pointing out how many electricians it'll take to install all the chargers and pointing out that if you want 500,000 chargers, that's a lot of electrical work. And, you know, you can't really, you know, I'm not installing one of those things myself. Let's just put it that way. So, yeah, anything we can get people into the industry is a beautiful thing. So then at some point, then you decide to move over to the for-profit side and you get Streamline up and going. And when you started Streamline, I mean, you're based in San Diego. The goal was staying on that market. Like, what kind of deals are you guys working on?
Well, at the beginning, you know, we transitioned to the market rate side. And at that time, there was an upzoning that took place in some of the core markets. And we looked to take advantage of those and began acquiring a lot of and working with a lot of homeowners, but acquiring a lot of properties that were, you know, subject to that upzoning. So we began doing some very small row home and townhome type projects, 4 or 5 unit projects, and some small apartment deals until we were really able to identify some vacant lots and a little bit larger opportunities to get into some of the mid-sized deals that we, you know, were able to. So I think the plan was always to scale. And we began with the idea that we would acquire properties for infill development, but then also build them. And mm-hmm. as we began to, with those successes, finish off some of our smaller projects, we began to pick up steam and realized that it takes as much brain damage to develop a 20-unit project as it does to develop a 200-unit project. It's not a right. linear difference or a linear scale. There's
just another zero on the end at the end of the day.
Time and effort to get a 20-unit apartment project yeah. approved as it does a 200-unit apartment complex approved. So we began to scale, and we decided to go after sites that could hold many more units. 100 to 200 units is currently where we are as far as scale and size of project.
That's fun. And without getting too into the weeds here, I mean, you focused on the San Diego market. So like what's the demand in your market? Where do you see the most demand right now? Is it rentals? Is it homeownership? What kind of stuff are people demanding in your market?
Well, rentals are in high demand right now. We have in San Diego specifically, this goes for all California markets, but San Diego specifically, we have a very significant supply side issue. We are constrained in the number of units being provided. And so the demand continues to be high. While there are discussions of exodus out of California, the population continues to increase in San Diego, and the gap between for sale and rental side of things, it continues to widen. And so right. because of that, the demand on rental properties continues to increase. And so we have seen a significant demand and especially legislatively a push towards increasing our supply of multifamily housing development for rent. And so because of all of that, that's really been our focus is mixed use, but mostly primarily residential multifamily properties because of that. And the city of San Diego, to its credit, has been very progressive in staying ahead of the curve and attempting to approve the right type of legislation that allows for the amount of housing that we need to be built. And I'm sure you're familiar with regional housing needs assessments.
Yep.
And California produces them every 8 years. The 8 year cycle that we're currently in requires 108,000 housing units to be built over those 8 years. And we're currently in San Diego, that is, and we're currently producing less than a third of that.
So you're just not going to get there. You're not going to get
there.
It's
just not getting
there. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's funny because, you know, when I talk to people who operate at a national level, you know, they talk about, oh, there's this huge amount of, there's huge glut coming onto the market and rents are going to drop because there are a gazillion units coming on board. And I'm like, yeah, at the national level, that's great. But there are a number of markets I can think of, yours being one of them, where you're not, that's not the trend you're seeing. What you're seeing is still a burgeoning population and not enough product being built. And, you know, part of that, you know, part of that definitely is a regulatory environment issue. You just can't build everywhere you want. And part of it is also, it just seems there's been a huge boom in the number of renters. A lot of renters by choice now, as opposed to, you know, you rent because you're then going to get married and have, you know, 2.5 kids and buy a house in the burbs. It's right. Interesting. Exactly. It's definitely interesting.
What you see is that gap between what you can afford widening because, you know, with the increase of you know, with inflation at where it is, the AMI levels continue to increase in San Diego. And the lack of supply, houses continue to get more and more expensive. For sale homes continue to get more and more expensive. And so because of that, more people cannot afford to have a $12,000 to $15,000 mortgage. You know, they said, well, I'm going to have to rent a 3 or 4 bedroom apartment for my family rather than buy a house. And so that gap continues to increase despite the fact that rents are continuing to go up. And so for a lot of those reasons, like you mentioned, nationally, you don't see a lot of these same trends, but in California markets and not all California markets, but specifically San Diego, we do feel like there is a bit of an insulation to this market because of the supply side and economics, and that the difficulty, the barrier to entry in buying a house in San Diego.
Let me talk a little bit about barrier to entry. And this is less about the consumer and more about the business. So you're a local developer. Obviously, there are national developers out there. You know, there's the Hineses of the world. Are you seeing national players in San Diego? Or are you still seeing pretty much just like big local guys? Because my sense of San Diego is you're a big market, but I don't know if you're not like Dallas. You know what I mean? You're not so big that you're getting institutional capital allocations. Or am I wrong? I don't know.
No, you're right about that. And it's an interesting point because in Los Angeles and San Francisco, the two bigger cities in California that institutional capital is already centralized, there's no issues with distributing capital to those cities. But in San Diego, because it's relatively smaller, you don't have that focus. There are some very few institutional investors and developers that come to San Diego, but it's nuanced in San Diego. There's so many different sub-markets that have such different feel to them that it's difficult for a national developer to really get an advantage. And the other part of it is, of course, that there's just not enough land in San Diego.
And right. And
institutional, and like wants that scale in order to be able to invest.
Like when you're talking about a project of a couple hundred units, like on one hand, that's a good size project. Don't get me wrong. But like to a national, that's just not worth getting out of bed. Like, you know, unless they're dropping hundreds of units at a shot, it's like, forget that. We'll stay in San Fran. We'll stay in LA. We'll do bigger markets. Now, yeah, it's interesting.
It's considered a small to medium sized project for a lot of those large institutional development players, unless it's like a tract home development. A 200 unit tract home development is a whole other story, but that's not the type of development that's currently being pushed in San Diego. It's all infill.
Right.
And so
that's where the
net result is you have a lot of local small to medium sized infill developers that are going to work and getting projects approved versus larger national developers. And there's actually another interesting piece to that is that the local regulatory environment is a lot better for a local boots to the ground infill developer.
Sure.
It's hard to know or understand what's happening locally in each individual submarket if you're not here. Whereas in Los Angeles or San Francisco, as those submarkets sit, it's a lot easier to have, you know, an office there or have contacts there, understand what's going on in Los Angeles and pick your spots. Whereas in San Diego, it is much more valuable and much more important to have that local presence. And it's just not a big enough city for the national developers to have that presence here.
Right. And as a local player, you understand the political environment you're operating in, you start to know the players, and there's a lot of benefit to that when trying to get sites approved. No, it's always interesting. So right now you're focused mainly on development. You're not doing investment like you maybe started out. Now it's really getting sites, it's getting them entitled, it's doing that sort of stuff.
Yes, we don't invest in other developers' projects. We solely acquire and develop ourselves. We actually don't even like to acquire properties that are already entitled or permitted. We like to take it from base level. And we
control everything. Sure.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's something that has sort of happened. It happens everywhere, but it happened a lot. It's happening a lot more in San Diego now, where you have some smaller guys who, because of the recent regulatory changes and shift toward developing around transit and increasing that density around transit, are now looking to entitle and flip. And so you have a lot of not even necessarily developers by trade, but brokers, other professionals that maybe do it as a side gig, will acquire a small property that has maybe a house on it, and they'll, you know, design and entitle and permit a 20 or 30 unit project and want to flip it. And so that's a whole nother industry now in San Diego, where you have some smaller guys that are looking to get some small developments done and sell them to another developer to build.
No, paper developers. And I mean, there's no sin in that. I mean, it's just not, it's not going vertical. I mean, you know, not to, you know, I'm working on a transaction like that right now, which is an older office building in Northern Jersey, which I think really could be redeveloped as a multifamily site. And, you know, we had the conversation internally about, okay, well, maybe we just get it under contract, move papers around a desk, create value, you know, dot, dot, dot. But yeah, but the danger is you might actually be forced to build the damn thing. And maybe that's not what you want to do. Maybe you just want to flip it to the next guy. And I hear you. And I definitely have also had conversations where local developers say, I really want to control the whole process. Like, I see you created value through that, but that doesn't mean I really want that. I want to run the process. So yeah, no, I hear you. I hear you. Well, this gets me to a question I always like to ask, which is my secret sauce question, if you will. And I think you've kind of answered it, which is, what kind of deals work for you that don't work for other people? And I think what I'm hearing a lot is it's a real focus on location. It's local knowledge. And it's also that you're really sort of taking it from day one. You're taking it from the beginning, which leads me to a question I was going to ask, which is, a lot of times those sites are not, in my experience, really marketed well by brokers. Brokers usually want to market stuff that, you know, frankly, it's easier to put your arms around. How are you finding development sites? What's worked for you in terms of finding potential projects?
Well, you know, I think that goes towards what you could say is, you know, kind of our secret sauce, you could say. You know, we because San Diego has such a high barrier to entry, like we were talking about, you know, what separates us from most others in our market and all those that are maybe trying to enter the market from Los Angeles, for example, really is that legislative edge. We are positioned to understand what is in the pipeline of the city and what's upcoming, what kind of development regulations are changing. And we can actually, we're in a unique position to help shape and create that upcoming policy. So this allows us to, gives us the opportunity to update and craft our strategic acquisition strategy for the upcoming year or 2 years, not just based on the market and the current condition of the market and the current regulations, but also on upcoming regulations at the city level that others don't necessarily know about yet. You know,
or understand. For example,
Yeah, right. You know, we are currently under construction. We have 200 units under construction now, another 1,000 in the pipeline. One we just broke ground on in September is a 137 unit deal in the North Park area, which is a very, you know, very up and coming submarket in San Diego, just outside of Balboa Park. That's a great example of that, because for that deal, when we tied up the property, it was zoned for 42 units. The base zoning plus a density bonus, we could get 42 units. However, we knew and understood that there were upcoming changes to the density regulations that would allow us to increase the density to well over 100 units. So we offered at the time what was perceived as top of the market for that area, for that property, but would end up actually being a very accretive land basis. So those are the times.
You basically got it for half. I was just going to say you overpaid, but if effectively you got it for half price. Yeah, yes, because you're doubling the units.
Right. And
that
can't be the strategy every time. We look for those types of opportunities every year when they have their regular land development code updates and changes. But that's the type of strategy we implement to stay a little bit ahead of the competition. That's in this game, you have to have a little bit of an edge. And you know, that's really kind of our main edge, is that legislative edge.
Well, and that's an excellent point. I mean, you know, it's funny because, I mean, you know, I get listeners for all kinds of different backgrounds. And, you know, what people seem to forget is that in the land of like securities and regulated securities, you know, if you use knowledge other people don't know about, that's insider trading, that's a felony, right? In real estate, it's just good business. And I think that's really the fundamental difference between us and the securities industry. I've always wondered how the heck they make money, because if you can't use information that no one else has, then you're just then how do you make money? Like there's no benefit to knowledge. But that's excellent. That's excellent. And, you know, I like talking to guys like you about stuff like this, because what you're talking about is really the fundamentals. It's knowing a market. It's building relationships. It's understanding trends. It's understanding how communities evolve over time, as opposed to sort of the flim flam of just, you know, we're going to raise a bunch of money, we're going to do a bunch of stuff, and don't worry, it'll all go up, you know, which you saw a lot of during this window of time the last few years. There are a lot of guys who got into the market that I really wonder why they were doing what they did. So one other question I always like to ask, for good or bad, nothing ever works out as expected. Recent surprises, things that sort of took you off guard, anything like that you feel like sharing from a recent transaction?
Sure. Yeah. It's interesting. We, for good.
It could be good or bad. I'm open.
Well, there, you know, I think most developers can probably relate to this, but, you know, everybody gets that email from a broker that has this amazing property and, and can do X amount of units and gives you all the information about what's there and, you know, what the title issues might be, and there's nothing there, and it's a great property and it's market price. They don't tell you the price. And then you call the broker and the whisper price is lower than what you underwrote. Always nice.
Always good.
All day. We actually came about, I'd say, on the other side of the scale, the worst surprise, we were in escrow on a piece of property in Bankers Hill, which is just north of downtown San Diego along Balboa Park.
Okay.
One of the best submarkets in the city.
Okay.
And we were in escrow on a relatively small piece of property there, about 10,000 square feet. And it was an optometrist's office.
Okay.
And we were looking to scrape and redevelop it for between 70 and 100 units, depending upon certain circumstances. And we were most of the way through our due diligence. We submitted to the city. And one of the biggest issues that you see in the city of San Diego, biggest barriers to development, is historic resources.
And okay.
That has really become almost weaponized in the city of San Diego by the NIMBYs to prevent new development.
Right.
Whenever possible. And so we submitted to the city and expecting full clearance very quickly. And it took a little bit longer than we would have felt liked. And they ended up referring it to the Historic Resources Board for designation, by which point that it was designated. And
we're
talking about a dilapidated, abandoned optometrist's office that got designated for really no reason at all from our perspective. Those are the types of things that in San Diego, there's always going to be a knife edge somewhere in the place that you develop. that is going to be the one in San Diego for the most part. In that circumstance, we actually spent about a year and a half analyzing, providing structural analyses, and ended up fighting and appealing that designation to the city council and prevailed. But it took an extra $150,000 and a year and a half of everybody's time in order to arrive at the same conclusion that, yes, we can still build a 70 to 100 unit project there.
And, you know, maybe this is my personal bias being a New York City native and the East Coast being a lot older than the West Coast. You know, from my perspective, nothing in California should be historic. So when people talk about, you know, well, this is a historic whatever, I'm like, well, you know, the whole state hasn't been around for very long anyway. I mean, it's all perspective. And I shared this recently with a colleague of mine who I realized after I was halfway giving my opinion, he reminded me that he was from Europe. And of course, from his point of view, we were all just babies. You know, it's all history is a matter of perspective. But no, your point about using historic preservation as a weapon is dead on right. It's interesting how often that's been used. I've seen it used in a couple of my markets also, where you could get demolition permits to take down old buildings. But the moment you did, someone locally was like, well, but this building goes back to whatever. And I'm like, come on, it's just it's an old pizzeria. Like,
exactly.
It's not,
and the problem with that is that it's all subjective. It's not based on objective criteria. And the biggest issue that California cities are having is this discretionary review that is all subjective. And that is the way that housing is being prevented. You know, we need more objective criteria by which to build. And if you follow that objective criteria, you should simply get the building permits. And, you know, developers and folks in Texas, for example, that I have developer friends that have gone out there and go to build their mansion, and they walk in with a thick stack of structural and MEP drawings and architectural sets that are an inch thick. And go to submit for their permits, and they say, what are you talking about? Just go ahead and build it. Let us know when you're ready for an inspection.
Yeah, well, like, we don't need any of that. Yeah. Why are you wasting my time? No, you can't have all of it. You can't have everybody get a seat at the table and then expect things to move quickly. And don't get me wrong, I think a lot of people look at developers who are not in development and they think we're anti-regulation. It's not anti-regulation, I think, as much as just having clear regulation. You know, you give me clarity, I can work with it. But yeah, if you make it just whimsical, then what the heck are we doing here?
Keep
then you're
the goal
just wasting
where
our time.
It is, don't move the goalpost, and we'll be able to work together in getting exactly what everybody wants.
Right. Then we can build some housing and everyone will be happy. And then certain things won't get built and that'll be fine, but at least we'll have clarity. So just a few closing thoughts here. Interest rates have gone kind of crazy, as I'm sure you're aware. Maybe they're going back down. You know, obviously that affects the financing of projects in the short term. But as a firm, like next year, 2 years, 5 years, stay in San Diego, work into other markets, do something other than apartments, or just kind of keep sticking to your knitting? How do you want to grow the firm, I guess is my question.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't be telling you anything earth-shattering if I told you the general consensus is that, you know, it's been bad for the last 12 to 24 months. But the general consensus is that, at least in San Diego and with the investment groups that we're talking with and the lenders that are currently active and restarting, is the outlook over the next 12 to 18 months is very positive. Interest rates will begin to subside, and along with the rates, spreads will also begin to decrease, which will just open up lending nationwide. Banks have basically shut down for non-recourse construction lending are opening back up, and investor requirements for returns on their capital will likely follow suit. So, you know, the broader economic outlook seems good and may take a bit longer. The benefit of San Diego, like we talked about, is that insulated market. And so it's going to be a quicker return to COVID and pre-COVID norms from our perspective. You know, our outlook on San Diego, we are still very bullish on the San Diego market. And it all goes really back to what we learned in college, right? Just the basic supply side economics prevent any major dip or recession locally in San Diego. And so, you know, the plan for us for the next 12 to 36 months, we'll say, the next 1 to 3 years, is really continue our core strategy of development in core markets where possible.
Sure.
But given the squeeze of the market with costs going up across the board, we're certainly looking to expand our footprint into additional secondary submarkets within San Diego, within the city of San Diego.
Right, but still staying in the metro. Got it.
Yeah,
got it.
Right. The state and the city, but the state has been pushing really this missing middle income housing, where you have, you know, look at San Diego specifically, you have your high earners, which can afford to buy a $1.5-2 million home. And then you have your renters, and the gap is really significant. And even the renters, the what's being charged for rent is outlandish. And so there's this missing middle, which is basically your normal income earners, your teachers, your firemen, you know, your police.
They've got good solid jobs, and in a different economy, they would be homeowners. But now they can't get that first rung on the ladder, if you will.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And so the push has been for the type of housing that is affordable to your middle income earners. And so along with that has been some legislation that's been put in place to promote middle income housing. And the secret is trying to figure out how to acquire property at a good enough land basis to be able to afford to put a deed restricted middle income housing model together. So I think over the next 12 to 24 and 36 months, we're looking to crack the code and expand into not just the luxury rental market that we've been working on, but also into that workforce housing, missing middle income housing rental model in San Diego as well.
Excellent. Well, look, this has been very constructive. I think we've definitely covered our material. This is Josh Carr, and I was speaking with John Allen, founder and president of Streamline Development Group. And again, their web address is streamlinedevelopmentgroup.com. John, thanks again for coming on.
Josh, thank you. Really appreciate it.
Great.